Welcome to today's episode of Fire in the Belly. This is where we get to hear some pretty inspiring stories from some amazing people. You know, it's always an absolute pleasure to sit down, take time out, and have a warts and all conversation about their journey. I'm always intrigued by what it's taken for people to get to where they are today. And hopefully, in this interview, we get to hear some more about that. From this, my mission is to help people to find their own fire in their belly, and from that, to live the mightiest version of you. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy today's guest. Success is a process, not an event. Hello and welcome to Fire in the Belly. Today we have myself, Mighty Pete, and we're joined by Andrew Stawes. Good afternoon. Yes, good afternoon for you.
It's definitely afternoon here in beautiful Bangkok, Thailand. So, well, I'm glad to be here, Pete, to meet you and talk more and meet your audience.
Yeah, well, listen, thank you for coming on. It's I know we're sort of, I'm going on your show next week, I think it is, and you know, vice versa, it's a pleasure to have you here. So, yeah. Andrew, give us an overview. Who are you? What are you doing? Where are you from?
So, I live in Bangkok, Thailand. I'll work backwards a little bit. I'm 55 and I live in Bangkok, Thailand. I have two companies here that I co-own with my business partners. And let's just say that I'm crazy about finance. And I got a CFA, meaning a chartered financial analyst designation. And then I also got a PhD in finance at the age of 50. And if somebody's watching this video, they can see a lot of books behind me. I read a ton of stuff on finance. So I really love finance, and that's really my love. And I love teaching, and I love also, you know, learning. And so that's where I am. And what I also do in my free time is my podcast called My Worst Investment Ever. And it's a chance to get to know people and listen to their worst investment and listen to them process that and see what they can learn from that. And then also bringing in my own perspective to that. So it's become a place where I can share some of my stories and my experiences. And so, and I live with my 82-year-old mother here in Bangkok, Thailand. And so that's where I am today. But if I go back in time, I grew up in Ohio in America. And by the age of 17, I had had a couple of suicide attempts. And I spent almost a year in three different drug rehabs and was in very, very, very difficult situation at that time. And that was, you know, let's say at the age of 17 that I got sober and stopped drinking and using drugs. And from that date, September 15th, 1982, until today, I've been clean. So I live that life, could say a 12-step program type of life. And that kind of defined me at a young age, that set me off like a rocket. And from the age of 17, I took off. And I think I just haven't stopped running since then. And that's how I would describe myself in a little nutshell.
Is running, is that in a positive context, or is that a running away from or running to, or what's the polarity?
Well, I was thinking about the word when I was saying it. You know, oftentimes when you say running, it usually means we're running away from something or we're running towards something. I would just say that all of a sudden life opened up for me, and life was harder before I got sober. And it was painful, and I was hurting people around me, and I was hurting myself. And then all of a sudden, life got a lot more simple. It got easier. And I just felt like a huge weight was lifted off, and I started realizing I can go wherever I want. I can do whatever I want. And that was kind of, I was let free. And maybe I bounced around like a ping pong ball for many years, but with a ton of energy. And then I just kept, you know, pursuing whatever it was. As I always tell people, you know, they say, how do you get successful in your work and all that stuff? And I say, quit. And I say, if you find something that you don't like, quit. And if you can quit a lot, it's going to send you away from the things that don't work and towards the things that work. And that's really the story of my life. And, you know, there was a time when I was talking about my mom yesterday. My dad passed away about 4 years ago. But I remember when I was young, he sat me down. He's like, "You're doing great and all that, but man, you're just bouncing off of one thing to another and you're never going to make anything out of yourself. You know, you got to get some focus." And, you know, I knew he was right, but I still kept bouncing because there's just so many things to experience. But eventually, at the age of 26, I moved to Thailand. And I decided I was going to take up a big challenge to see if I could make it here. And at the age of 28, I found the job of my dreams, which was to be a financial analyst at a broker investment bank. And when I started that job, I just knew that day that this is what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And so ultimately, if someone says, you know, "Who are you?" I say, "I'm an analyst at heart. I analyze things. I think about things. I try to build stories and cases and evidence about things." So, yeah. So a long answer to the question of whether I was running, I would say I was just bouncing.
That's interesting. And even, I suppose, with the podcast, what struck me there is, you know, it's kind of there's sometimes there's more lesson in the things, the bad stuff, you know, so it's learning by exception, right? So the stuff that you know, but you kind of go, well, what's happened over here and why was it your worst investment ever? Or you use the word yourself in terms of taking yourself to Thailand and challenging yourself, seeing what you're capable of.
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, a huge number of people say no to coming on my podcast. They're just not necessarily comfortable talking about their worst. And one guy says, he replied, you know, "Great idea for a show. It's not how I ride." And I think there's a lot of people that don't want to reveal their mistakes, or they just don't see the point of that. And some people don't want to be vulnerable. You know, I think this, but I find it empowering. And I think it also builds a closer relationship with the people that I get to know on the podcast, that we're talking about real things. And I would say, given that I went through a lot of trouble at a young age, I definitely learned to live a real life with real emotions, real friendships, you know, real tragedies, and not run away from them and face them and deal with them. And so the podcast is very real, you know, and that's what I like about it.
It sounds like, you know, that's going to hit your analyst brain, right? You know, it's kind of because you need to have an event to analyze. So if something's happened, and generally it's like, yeah, we can all talk about the nice fluffy stuff, but it's kind of what happened on the bad day that you can learn definitely more from.
Definitely. Yep.
What sort of strikes? It's a bit like is it black box thinking? Matthew Saeed, I think it is. You know, and they talk about that. You know, it's like the airplane. You know, the black box tells you what has happened.
Mm.
It's that sort of learning.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that mistakes and worst investment evers are combined with strong emotion, and we know from academic research now that the pain of losing is 2.5 times more painful than an equal gain. So we could say that there's a lot more emotional energy attached to your worst investment ever, which means that you remember it really well. And it impacts your life. I mean, there's people, their worst investment has shaped their whole life, and they actually are terrified to ever invest again, or they never trust anybody, you know, like that. The pain and the terror is very real. And sometimes in my podcast, what I enjoy is that it's a catharsis. It's a confession. Many times people come to the end of the episode and they say, you know, I never really talked about that before. And I think then, you know, you've really done something good, because you've gotten someone to process something and learn from it. But also, as I always, when I prep my guests, I always tell them, you know, you need to really visualize that man or woman out there who's just about to make the same mistake. And you need to speak to them, not with, you know, facts and this and that, but with emotion, because it's ultimately the emotion that grabs us.
And that's interesting coming from a sort of an analyst, because I mean, do you bring emotion into it? Are you logically brained?
Well, one of my courses, I have a bunch of online courses and live courses I teach in my free time. one of them is a course on how to give a great presentation. And the first step of that course, I have people take a left brain, right brain test. You know, it's just kind of for fun to try to think about how you think. And in my world, many people are left brain, which I call logical left. And then fewer people are what I call romantic right. And so I am 86% logical left, which is a very high. I don't think I've seen any of my students have as high a number as that. So I am definitely a very logical guy, but because I went through that tragedy and because of drug addiction and all that, and because I was kind of forced by my parents and by my situation to deal with it, I learned how to feel. And I can remember a counselor had a piece of cardboard that he would hold up in front of me, and it had six faces on it and six words, one word after next to each face. And I can still remember it so clearly. This is 38 years ago. And he said, "How do you feel?" And I was like, "I don't know." And then he said, he pulled that thing up. It says, "Mad, glad, sad, hurt, ashamed, afraid. These are primary emotions. Which one do you feel? Which one do you feel most like? Are you mad? Are you glad? Are you hurt? Are you ashamed, afraid? What is the emotion?" And so I got coached on how to feel. And I learned that through, you know, many hours of therapy and just getting, you know, working that concept. So I'd say that, you know, the first thing is that I learned how to feel. The second thing is that very young in my career, I learned that if you could be an analyst that tells a good story, you're going to be a number one analyst, because most don't. They bring out facts and figures. And in my course on how to give a great presentation, I ask my audience, you know, close your eyes. And I'm going to ask the audience listening right now, close your eyes, unless you're driving, and close your eyes. And I just want you to think, and I'm going to ask you, Pete, to turn on your mic and reply to this. And I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you some words, and I want you to just tell me positive or negative, positive or negative.
Okay.
Red light.
Positive.
Okay. And accident.
Negative.
Family.
Negative.
Happiness.
Positive.
15.
Positive.
So now that ends the game, but the point that I try to make to people is that it's very rare that a number it evokes an emotion. Now, you know, if it was when you were 15, you met the love of your life, and you know, you have some connection to that number, but generally we have connections to words more than numbers. So I used to teach my analysts when I was head of research, and I do it myself, is I try to write in a way, particularly when I was writing research, where I try to remove numbers from the research and focus on the story. And instead of saying it grew by 100%, it doubled, you know, try to put the language in that way. So I learned at an early age that the story and the structure of how you argue their point, you know, it's probably much more valuable than the strength of your numbers.
Are numbers factual? I suppose they are. Are they? I don't know.
Well, in the world of finance, sometimes they can be manipulated. They can be fraud. They can be fraudulently presented. But I guess one answer to that is, you know, if I owed you 15 pounds and I paid you 14, would you accept it? Well, you would say, well, that was only 14. So to some extent, you could say they're kind of provable and they're knowable. But, you know, everything can be challenged, of course.
Can you challenge a number as much as you can challenge a word? I mean, I suppose that you can put
words
a
have meaning. Words have meaning. And we have dictionaries defining words the meaning of words, but we do not have dictionaries defining the meaning of numbers. And so generally what I've experienced is that, you know, getting focused on the meaning, the story, the emotion. That's what, you know, and in the world of presentation, of course, it's a hook. We want to hook people in to listen, to learn, and to pay attention. And what I've learned is that hooks, always the best hooks are emotional. Grabbing someone's emotion is, you know, just telling someone, you're going to make 100% profit on this deal, you know, that's just not enough. You know, you've got to, you know, we're going to save the world. We're going to do this. Here's a chance to help 1,000 young kids, you know, in this slum in the Philippines, and think of how you're going to feel, you know, that's a much more powerful argument.
Mm. It's contextual, right? You know, it's, as you say, you can put something to it, or as you say, 100% profit could be, that could be huge, right? Or it could be, yeah, it's another 10 quid. It's
like, yep, exactly. So, and it could be just by, you could get that money by stealing or through some good purpose, you know, type of thing. So, and I always tell my students when I teach that is even finance people have emotion. So even when you're presenting to people that are numbers oriented, they have emotion and they like to smile and they want to enjoy your presentation. They do not want to sit there and listen to numbers. Now, they can work with numbers and they know how to do that, but that's not what they really want from the presentation.
Do you think of numbers? I mean, do you sort of calculate in your head? Do you see the numbers? You know, is it in your head, or give us a bit of an insight?
I mean, I would say that my stronger skill is structuring arguments, structuring my thinking, and numbers are just a tool to construct that thinking. You know, today, for example. Today, one of my clients said to me, you know, Andrew, I really need you to do a valuation on our company and tell us, you know, how much you think it's worth. And I said, well, I said, we have a piece of paper right here. Why don't we just do it right here, right now? And he's like, okay. And I just said, well, you know, you made $10 million, let's say, dollars in revenue. And you think you're going to be able to get that to $20 million in 3 years from now, and some comparable companies trade at a price to revenue multiple of 2x. So if you're 20 million, we're going to multiply that times 2x, and that's 40 million. But that's 2 years from now or 3 years from now, and there's some risk about getting there. So we're going to have to discount that, and that just discount means reduce, just like if you're walking past a store and you say, hey, there's a 30% discount. It means they reduce the price of 100 to 70. So we just have to discount or reduce that, you know, 40 by a certain amount. And I said in their case, well, let's just reduce it to 30 million. And that's how much you're worth, give or take 5 million. Depends on how we argue it. So the structure and the logic and the simplicity is my strength. The numbers are a tool to build the argument, to build the idea. That's the way I look at it. And maybe it's a little bit different. Like I know my father did, you know, he would do calculations in his head and really enjoy that. And, you know, that kind of is a little bit a different way of the way I look at it. I look at them as tools, you know, to construct stories and arguments, basically.
Do you have a sort of a moral code or an ethic when you're working with numbers?
Well, I definitely have a moral code. I mean, first of all, the thing that sets apart the chartered financial analyst designation is that there is a code of ethics that we're supposed to follow. And I teach ethics for new charter holders who are, you know, candidates that are trying to get to become a charter holder. I always say, you know, how many bachelor's degree, people with a bachelor's degree, do you think are in prison in the world? And they say, well, I don't know, 1 million, 10 million, whatever. And then I say, okay, how many people with a master's degree do you think are in prison? And they say, I don't know, 500,000? I say, how many people with a doctorate degree are in prison? And then they say, I don't know, 10,000, you know, whatever that number is. And I say, how many people do you think that have a CFA designation are in prison? And the answer to that question is zero, because you will be stripped, if you're convicted of a crime, you will be stripped of your CFA charter. So you will lose it. And of course, you can also be stripped of your CFA charter if you've been investigated internally by CFA and they've decided that you've violated some code of ethics or some other thing. So, and I teach the young people that anybody can learn how to do accounting and finance and discounting and all of that stuff. But, you know, what really sets us apart is our ethics. And I say, if you can, and I teach ethics in a positive way, I teach them 10 ways ethics can add value to you. And I talk about the way you interact with people and the way you do your work and confidentiality, trustworthiness. And I use a demonstration in class. I ask them, how many, if you had a secret, a deep, dark secret that you wanted to let out, but you didn't want the world to know, but you were willing to tell one person because you just had to get it off your chest. You know, you look at some of your friends around, maybe some people look at their parents and they say, I'm not telling them. They're going to use it against me or whatever. And then you think about some of the friends around you and they're going to, before 24 hours, they'll be all out on the street if I tell that guy. So then I ask them, how many people do you really trust? And the answer comes between 0 and 3. Occasionally you get people say 5, but I say, you probably haven't tested them enough. But I would say, you know, if you've got 3 people you can truly trust in your life, that's pretty damn good. And there's a great book that I read called Reality Therapy by a guy named Dr. William Glasser. And he talked about the importance of trust and how mental illness stems from a lack of trust. In other words, many, many mental illnesses stem from the fact that the person does not have one person in their life they can truly trust. And when that happens, our minds, our emotions start to build up coping mechanisms for that situation. So once I've gotten them to understand that there's very few people that you trust, then I ask them, if I was to ask your friends this question, would they choose you? And if they wouldn't choose you, now's your chance to become that rare individual that people trust. And if you can build that trust into your character on a daily basis, then you have built something very rare. And as I teach them in finance, rare is valuable.
Do you trust yourself?
I think so. I mean, if I look at my, I mean, where does trust come from? I tell people and students in particular that there is no shortcut or there's no hack for accelerating the trust between two people. Now, of course, you could have some kind of a tragedy. You fell out of an airplane and that guy saved you. Okay, you know, maybe there's a bond that you've formed through that very extreme experience. But if you just think about building trust, trust comes over time because you're observing the way a person interacts with you and with others. If you see someone being really trustworthy to you but cheating others, that teaches you something. And so I think that over time, and I suspect that confidence in life comes from trusting your reactions and you observe yourself. You know, I observe myself, how I handle the difficulty with my addiction. I observe myself and how I handle it when my sister died in 1998. I observe myself and how I handled the Asian financial crisis that nearly wiped me and my business partner out at the time. I observe myself the way I handled my father's passing. And I start to get some trust in the way I handle things. And I think that that's what makes people attractive as a leader as you get older, is if you can build a pattern of trust and good decision-making, you know, never going to be perfect, but good decision-making, I think that is a that is how you real leadership. But I mean, I'm just a little guy, so I'm not saying I have the, and in fact, in my courses, I always say, I'm not teaching this course to teach you all the different ways that you could do such and such. I'm teaching you the way I did it and I do it.
Is trust linked to truth?
What do you mean by that?
And I'm just mentally, I'm following up on your, you know, trusting 0 to 3 people.
Mm.
And then you talked about, you know, if, I suppose in my head, I'm jumping then and saying, well, there needs possibly, you know, question is, do you need to have an alignment of values to trust somebody? Because if they say, well, that's not the truth, can I trust somebody even though I know it's not the truth? You know, and that's why I'm kind of wondering, is it alignment of values, or can you trust somebody even though they may conflict with your values?
It's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure if I have a great answer. I mean, one of the things about living in Thailand is that I've now spent 29 years in Thailand, which is more time than I lived in the US. And that's caused me to have, in some ways you could say, a conflicting system, because I was kind of raised as Christian, although we weren't like a serious Christian family or something, but you know, Christianity was the foundation of, let's say, our society. And then I came here and the foundation is completely Buddhism, very different, very different. And then all of a sudden you have to, and then I did my PhD in China, and you find a very different style of thinking and of acting. And then you just realize that, actually, in a sense, all these things are made up. Societies are making up. You know, I'll tell you a story about how I used to travel around Asia a lot and give speeches and give courses and stuff. And one country in Asia, the Philippines, is Catholic. And they had this habit, whenever you give a speech there, they stand and sing the national anthem, and they also have someone to go up and give a prayer. And it's, you know, and then when you look at other countries and the things that they do, and you know, and then you look at, for instance, Philippines is kind of known for corruption and poverty and all that. And I sometimes wonder, you know, think that even though prayer is a big part of what they live for, but are prayers being answered? How do you square that with going and giving a speech in another country where there is no prayer, but yet people are not struggling and, you know, poverty and corruption and all that? And then what I came to the conclusion is that actually every society is making it up. And then I kind of came to the next conclusion, to the next level, which, you know, may or may not be true, but I was thinking that, you know, then I started looking at women around, and, you know, I've had some women that have come to me and said, you know, hey, I can take care of you, and I can cook for you, and I can, you know, clean, and I can do all this. And, you know, in Asia, that's a pretty attractive thing. And, you know, maybe in the West it also is, I don't know. But, and I thought to myself, you know, it's not at all what I want out of a relationship. But then I kind of felt bad that I was like walking away from that and saying, no, thanks. But then I realized, whoa, wait a minute. The behaviors that she is exhibiting are behaviors that are very attractive to Thai men, let's say. And then you kind of realize that society is structured by men to some extent, and women and also men to some extent. We behave in a way in our society that is attractive to the leaders of society who set that structure. And then I kind of realized really that it's just all made up. And that's been a really fun challenge, is to go around, go to China, stand in the middle of a street chaos. And, you know, you go in a restaurant. I was in a restaurant and there was a guy sitting at a table and he was spitting on the floor. in the restaurant. And then I thought to myself, you know, my first reaction is that's disgusting, that's gross, it's not what I would do. But then I thought to myself, wait a minute, this society has been around for 5,000 years. American culture, you know, has not. And then I started to think about, you know, why is, let's say, Western culture so refined in the way that we eat and all of this? And then I realized, okay, we made all that up. And in fact, you could say that that person that I saw in that restaurant was kind of closer to real nature. And actually, the customs and behaviors of, let's say, an upper class British person, as an example, is so far from the state of nature that it's almost bizarre when you look at it in that framework. So, you know, trying to break the frameworks that we were brought up under is really challenging. It's a really, you know, I oftentimes tell my students in my evaluation masterclass, if you leave my class feeling less confident, then I have succeeded.
You probably, well, yeah. I suppose the less confidence, but I mean, is that akin to the more you know, the more you realize you don't know?
I think it's part of that. Also, you know, finance is not a hard science like physics, where you can drop something and it falls at the same pace, you know, the same speed. But in the world of finance, it's there are no laws. But yet, young people study finance and try to take comfort in knowing the formulas and the calculations. But the formulas and calculations in the world of finance are their models, their hypotheses, their theories, but they're not laws. And the result of that is that what I try to do is shake the foundation and show them that actually, you know, you've got all this, what seems like certainty in these textbooks and what you're being taught, but actually you've been fooled into some comfort. But reality is that I'm here to tell you that just knowing those calculations is not going to solve the problem. And that's different if you're an architect, an engineer building a house. You know the calculations that you're going to do that are going to calculate the amount of weight that a floor can bear and the distance between, you know, pylons that are making a building type of thing.
Makes a lot of sense. I'm just I'm curious about your thinking. I mean, but by nature, do you prefer to create something or fix something?
I would say my history probably shows create, but what I really love is iterating through something. So let's say create and iterate, and I realize now as I manage people around me is that I'm the type of person that it's better to bring just a partially completed work and show me, and then let's discuss it, and then go to your next level and your next level and your next level. I build things in increments and then I advance them incrementally. And I think that's different. I mean, I have a guy that works with me who's my business partner. When we first started, he's a Thai man, and he's a real genius in so many different areas. But the thing that he did for me was he helped me to, like, I did something really odd. My top one or two skills was using Excel. And this was about the year 2000. And I was definitely a leader in the office. And, you know, I knew how to use Excel better than most of my peers. And then I hired him and he sat next to me and I was a bank analyst. And I said, you're going to do Excel models. And I gave up my number one strength or my number one or number two strength. I delegated it. That goes against everything you hear. You know, you delegate your weaknesses. I don't know how I had the guts to delegate that, but But I knew it took a lot of time. You know, that was one thing I wanted to get rid of. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to get rid of it. But then he and I worked together. And later, as I progressed through my career, he and I moved from one investment bank to another as my career progressed. And eventually we became business partners. But I went to work at this one investment bank, and one of my analysts was really struggling. And I said, look, why don't you let Sornsung, this man, help you? And he can do magic with what you're struggling with. So he says, all right, I'll try that. So a couple of weeks later, I went back to my friend and I, you know, we were working together. He was my subordinate. And I said, how did it go? He said, I didn't have him work on it. I just had him work on it a little bit. And then I kicked him off. I said, why? He said, yeah, just mistakes. You know, he made some mistakes and it was just annoying and all that. And that's when I kind of realized, oh, I see. Yeah, he does make mistakes. But I don't overlook those. I accept those mistakes because he can advance the whole package much faster than I could do on my own. And I realized, like, then it reinforced the incremental way that I iterate through things. It's like, okay, let's do the first draft of that and let's look at it. Oop, oop, there's a little mistake there, whoop, whoop, whoop. And then as we iterate through it, then we get to the result that we want. So I have a product called World Class Benchmarking, and it's a tool that I use when I'm picking stocks or when I'm consulting and helping companies to increase the profits of their business. And it's just a tool that allows us to see your company versus your global peers. And I just look at all the iterations I went through to get to the point where it is now, where I haven't changed it in years because it works now. But yeah, I went through a lot of iterations. So I'm a creator who iterates.
I'm intrigued by your handing over something, you know, you're saying in terms of Excel there, but what's sort of coming out is almost, is that like an artist's frustration? You know, it's like, if you can't get it perfect, kind of like a tantrum, it's like kind of going, well, if I can't get it perfect, well, I don't want it at all. You know, by giving it to someone else, it disassociates and it allows you to be more free flowing and saying, it's kind of better when I'm observing and I can dip in and dip out. But if I'm left here alone with it, it will drive me mad. And
well, I mean, I would say, I mean, that the time issue was a big issue that did, you know, was frustrating. But I don't think, I mean, I was good at it and I enjoyed doing it. You know, it wasn't like I was frustrated with it. So that's even more of why it was such a bold move at the time that I didn't even realize how bold it was until I now look back at it. And Sornsung has taken his Excel skills to the moon, his coding skills, his Excel skills, and my skills have been flat for 15 years. But I've produced, just as we're talking here, I'm seeing a missed call he just called. But as I have gone through all these years, I've produced amazing things out of Excel. I just haven't created them myself. And now he kind of makes fun of me that, you know, I can't even figure out this or that with this new stuff. And I'm like, yep. So, I mean, I do delegate my weaknesses also, but that was a bold move. And really it turned me into, it allowed me to get out on the stage, which is what you've got to do if you're a sell side analyst, you know, selling your research to fund managers. So, and that I later learned was more valuable than, you know, crunching numbers.
It's funny you say this, because on our reading group this morning, there was a quote that came out and we don't know the origin of it, but the quote was, only do what only you can do. And it sort of rings true there. And, you know, you can do Excel, you know, and as you say, it's in your sort of top two skills as such. But yet you're not the only one that can do it. And you know, you've stood aside and actually realized that certain things you're maybe better at selling the model or the psychology of it or teaching and learning about finance, right? You know, so it allows a lot more.
Well, it goes on to another interesting topic. I find myself as an analyst, as a financial guy, a very hard topic is marketing for me. and trying to understand that. And one of the things that they talk about in marketing is USP, your unique selling proposition. And sounds pretty simple until you go onto the internet and you look at the definition of unique, and it says being the only one of its kind, unlike anything else. And then you realize what most people are saying is their unique selling proposition is not unique at all. And then when you start to really dig down and ask that question, you know, what is unique about myself, about my company, about our service? And that's a very much harder question than it appears in the marketing books that I read.
Do you know what you know? Do you appreciate that?
I'm not sure if I understand it's a sort that of question.
You know, unconscious competence, put it that way. You just do it, you know, and you, it's like when someone says, yeah, you just move these 15 formulas and do this and pull in this strategy and then you apply this, and this, and everyone's going, you lost me at step one, right? And you're going, what are you, thick? You know, it's like.
Yeah. Well, I'd say, I saw a video of a guy that said, I did 10,000 hours of practice, music practice, in 6 months. And it goes, he was talking about the 10,000 hour rule. And he was a young guy. He was in the middle of his master's degree. He took 6 months off to go play in the Caribbean with a bunch of guys that were like top notch. And there was a jazz bar nearby and they would play all night there. So he had about 8 hours of play, another 6 hours of practice, and then some sleep and some partying or whatever. And he did that for 6 months. And he was like, it transformed me in my ability to hear music, to write music, to play music. And then I started kind of calculating that, you know, he's working on his craft as a job. And that's what I was doing and have been doing in finance. So I asked myself, like, okay, how many hours have I been working? And so I just wrote a post on Facebook that said, I just completed my 60,000th hour in building my experience in finance in particular. And maybe you could say in life for all of us. So the point is that as we get older, we definitely, you know a lot more, which I appreciate that. But I also think that, you know, I've seen so many different cases, just like anybody else that's experienced in the world of finance. There's really not, there's nobody I couldn't go up against. If I was put on a stage to debate somebody in some topic in the world of finance, I'm not intimidated by anybody. I don't have arrogance and I don't know it all. But I do know enough to debate almost any topic in that space. But also, it's nice not having imposter syndrome either. I see, you know, young people that are facing that challenge of, you know, I wanna do this, but I know I don't have that much experience. And I kind of like the idea of just go out and do it, get a step ahead, you know. But it's nice not having that. But I would also say the other thing I would add to it is that, I don't get frustrated with people that don't understand finance because I'm a teacher, right? When I first came to Thailand, I started teaching finance at university full time. I did that for a year until I figured out I wasn't going to be able to make any money. But then I taught part-time all the time. And so I'm still associated with a university here in Thailand. And I still have my online courses and I do some other live type of courses. And what I love to do is take complex things and simplify them. So I'm very, I can acknowledge the fact that this is very hard. And I was working actually, there's an intern working with me who's right behind my desk here. And he's working on helping me create this workbook. And he was going through and kind of taking out little highlights of this and that from a lecture I was giving. And I was like, it's not my style to bring out little highlights. When it comes to finance, you can't skip a step. The minute you skip a step, because you think people would know that, you've lost them. So show your work, show your steps, and help people, you know, walk through it. So I have a course that I just did with my two of my executive MBA and MBA program here, and it's called Finance Made Ridiculously Simple. And it's really a course, it's an online course, but I love to do it live. It's a 2-day live course. But basically I teach them a basic concept, and then I through a repetitive process, I show them 10 companies in 10 different sectors and how to interpret that across all of them. And then we break out into groups and stuff. So by the end of it, it's definitely made ridiculously simple. And that's part of my business is teaching people on management teams how to understand the finances of their business.
How much accumulated? I mean, I assume by the fact that you're saying, you know, finance made simple means that actually people need it broken down. But I suppose in the corporate world, how much fluff gets carried or generated with numbers? Is it a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just like we talked about how the word 15 doesn't really have emotions attached to it, I would say so many people are throwing around numbers and without much meaning. And we have a part of our business is consulting to help. We call it outsourced CFO. And the purpose of that is that even many companies have CFOs, but it's like they're speaking another language. And so part of what I've realized is one of the reasons why companies are successful is because everybody on the management team understands the finances of the business. And one of the reasons why companies aren't financially successful is because it's only the CEO or the CFO that understands it. And so part of what I do through this coaching and, let's say, mentoring and teaching is to make sure everybody on the management team understands it. So I have a product called World Class Benchmarking Scorecard, and that's a one-page document with no financial ratios. It's a ranking from 1 to 10 on these core principles. And I use that to simplify. And once you get the management team all understanding and looking for the score, and then I break the management team down into 4 groups. And I call it, I tell students that I'm going to teach you the 4 ways that you can add value in a business. There's only 4 ways. And I stand up and I turn around and I show them the back of my Levi jeans. And I say, what's this? And they say, ass or whatever. And I say, well, that's rear. And that stands for revenue, expense, assets, and risk. So the 4 ways you can increase the value of a business is increase the revenue. That's the R in rear. Decrease the expenses. That's the E in rear. Decrease the assets that are in the business or get more from existing assets. And finally, reduce the risk. And mathematically, those things fit into the framework of valuation. And therefore, I set up rear teams on management, you know, with management to say, who's going to volunteer to be in charge of moving the ball forward in the area of revenue, expense, assets, and risk. And then the scorecard matches those areas so that we can look at the progress that's being made. So I can't remember your question, but that's my answer. And I'm sticking with it.
My brain's sort of trying to track you along. So yeah, I don't know. It'll come back to me what the answer was. So the question was, what's your worst investment ever?
Well, basically, I had a good friend of mine, and he had an idea of starting a language company, and which was. He's a brilliant guy, and he had written a book about speaking Thai, learning how to read, write, and speak Thai. He wasn't a Thai person, but I contributed the capital to that company, and then we started kind of going off track, came back on track. Then things started to progress. We used to have meetings to try to keep things on track. Then things started to get better, but then we thought, oh, this is much bigger. We want to do something bigger. And then we started pivoting into something bigger and very different from where we started. And then we decided to get there. We've got to hire some people and all that. And so we hired a really great, you know, guy that became a great friend. And then he was doing the coding and, you know, he was doing a lot of stuff. And then basically I realized we got far away from what we originally did. And what I realized was that my friend he was great at creating and all that, but execution was hard for him. And I just didn't feel like we could get there. And then I had to pull the plug on the funding. And when I pulled the plug, of course, I lost all the money that went into that. And it was a crushing blow. And we've kept our friendship through that, but it was definitely, you know, hard. And I should have known better, as many of my guests say, you know, seasoned financial guy, and yet I missed a lot of the signals. So nowadays, when people ask me about investing in startups, I always say, you know, look for trust first. If you trust the person and you trust the team, go to the next step. Next step is the idea good? If the idea is bad, doesn't matter that you trust them. Then if the idea is good and you trust them, then go to the next one, which is execution, and ask, can these people execute this in a very competitive environment? If the answer is no, then it doesn't matter that you trust them and the idea is good. And then the lesson that I learned also was that if you trust them, the idea is good, and they can execute it, the next question is, do they have the money? Or are you the sole provider of the funds? And so I think it may be that you were the sole provider at the beginning, but then your job really is to diversify that and make sure you get other investors into it. So, you know, that's what I learned from that experience, and it was very painful. And yeah.
Is there any, I was curious whether there's any connection between your investment per se, and, you know, and you talked about sort of drugs and the rehab. I mean, was that a bad investment?
Well, I mean, certainly devoting time to smoking dope and getting high and drinking and all that, you know, you could argue was a bad investment, and it was a very risky investment of time. And, you know, it's, as one of my friends said from those days, he said, my life is about inches and seconds. And I just happened to be on the right side of those inches and seconds to make it to where I am today. But I would say it definitely was a high risk situation, that a lot of bad things could have happened that would have been even worse. But then, of course, the great thing about my podcast and people going through their worst investments is that oftentimes that worst investment is your defining moment. And so, yes, you can argue, you can definitely say that, you know, we're forged. I had a magazine come and interview my business partner and I, and one of our businesses is a coffee factory called Coffee Works in Bangkok. We have about 100 employees, and it's a B2B coffee roaster. And we got interviewed about how our business started, and we started 25 years ago, just before the Asian crisis, which the center of it was in Bangkok, where we started our business. And so we had to move into the factory, and it was just a really tough time, really tough time.
Did you cause the crisis?
Yes, exactly. I was the one that lit that fire. So, but the guy that was interviewing me asked me, how would you describe your business experience? And I said, forged in the fire of failure.
There's an expression I love, and it's more and more common, and I don't know whether it is, you know, cause typically people on Fire in the Belly are successful, but it seems to be the contrast, and the expression is really down to, you know, from great overwhelm comes great change. And I wonder with a worst investment, as it's tagged, you know, it is great overwhelm for multiple reasons.
Yep.
Comes great change.
Yeah.
You know, and it sort of tallies what you said, you know, people saying, well, do people come away going, I'll never do that again, or I've learned, or?
I think people come away with the fact that they've learned. I think we end up making new mistakes and finding new ways to lose money and finding new ways to not have learned from what we've done. But generally, you know, I think people come away saying, you know, I'm not going to do that again. But, you know, there's new ways. You know, one thing that might be interesting for the listeners out there is that, given that I was an analyst and have been an analyst really all my life, I analyzed all the stories that I got, and I put them in a spreadsheet, and I tried to group them into different categories. And eventually I came up with 6 common mistakes. And if you'd like me to tell you about them, I will.
Yeah, please. That'd be awesome.
So the number one most common mistake is failed to do their own research. So most people are losing money because they just don't spend any time researching what they're doing. They don't spend time thinking about it, investigating it, all of that. That's number one. Number two, most common one, is failed to properly assess and manage risk. Assessing, I would say, is before you put money into something. And managing risk is as you put money into something or after you put money into something. And so, number one, failed to do their own research. Number two, failed to properly assess and manage risk. Number three is driven by emotion or flawed thinking. And there's a lot of behavioral finance stuff about the way we think and our emotions. So I combined them into one and said, when you get messed up in your emotions or flawed thinking, you've made mistake number three. And that's the third most common mistake. The fourth most common mistake is just a pretty simple one, misplaced trust. You just gave your money to somebody you didn't trust. And it was, you know, that you trusted, but you shouldn't have. And then it was gone. And then it brings us to number five, which is failed to monitor their investment. So the point is that many people also give their money to people who they trust. But, you know, if you leave money on a table in a neighborhood, it's quite likely that nobody's going to take it because everybody knows each other. But if you leave it there for a year, somebody's eventually going to take it. Even somebody you trust is going to be seduced by that. So fail to monitor their investment. So this is these are the five. Now, the sixth one was just a catch-all. I found that this one actually had everything in it, all five of them in it. And this is invested in a startup company, which was my worst investment and was also, I think, what, you know, what many people, you know, experience. And what I have a speech that I give called Six Ways to Lose Your Money and Six Strategies to Win. And it breaks down these six things. And I do the speech through telling the story of six guests. And then after each story, I say, how can we mitigate this risk? And I say with investing in a startup, you need to start with the fact that you're going to lose all your money. And that's because the odds of winning and starting a business is so low. And it's binary. You're either going to become a multi-billion gazillionaire or you're going to have nothing. And you'll be crying to sleep, yourself to sleep, because you lost everything. So those are the six common mistakes that I've learned from now almost 300 podcasts on my worst investment ever.
How does that link to human emotions? Because I'm sort of getting there, like greed. I'm getting there, hope. I'm getting... integrity, you know, it's like kind of going, yeah, kind of deep down, I know this is not going to work, but I kind of hope it is, or, you know, the emotions that we're blinded by, right?
I think the foundational emotions in the world of finance are greed and fear. And, you know, there's that, you know, the FOMO, fear of missing out, is fear. And, you know, rushing into something that you don't research is greed. Now, fail to properly assess and manage risk is a little bit more of knowledge, like even knowing. I give an example in one of my courses that's called How to Start Building Your Wealth Investing in the Stock Market. And I say, imagine that a Martian comes down from Mars. They land on the Earth. They land next to a highway where cars are racing by. And the Martian stops a car and he asks the driver, he's a friendly Martian. He asks the driver, hey, do you mind if I try to drive your car? And he's like, no problem. And he gets in and he says, here's the gas, here's the brake. The Martian gets in the car. He loves it. He just gives it, guns it. He goes as fast as he possibly can. And then he crashes into a tree. And he's thrown from the car out the window and he's dead. Now, why is he dead? He's dead because he didn't wear his seatbelt, but he didn't know about his seatbelt. He never asked and they never told him. And he had a risk-reducing tool right there right at his fingertips. And he would have been able to live through it, but he didn't know it. And so I think that's the way most people invest. It's like when you see, for me, when I see people investing, for most people, if you can picture this, a little baby crawling, gaga, goo goo, you know, like 3 months old, is oblivious to the world around them. And they're crawling through a rattlesnake den. Hundreds of snakes. And what is that baby doing? Oh, wow, wow. You know, and it's touching things. And it's, yeah, it has no clue to the risks that it's taking. And in life and in the world of finance, you are not rewarded for taking unnecessary risk. If it's risk that could have been mitigated, you're not rewarded for that. And so it's really one of the things I like to do through that course is to try to teach people what is your seatbelt and what is your airbag. And if you can know those two things, you're ahead of the majority of people.
Is compounding the seventh wonder of the world or eighth wonder, whatever it is?
Well, first of all, that was not spoken by Einstein. That's an urban myth. But yes, the power of compounding is great, but most people will never, ever, ever get it. Because it has two features that most people can never really reach. First, you got to start when you're young. You need 40 years. Like I say to my students, I can guarantee you a way you can get rich in the stock market. But the bad news is it's going to take 40 years. So number one, you got to start early. And the second thing is you got to contribute regularly and leave the money in. And if you don't do those three things, you will get some benefit of compounding, but you won't get the magic of compounding. Because, Pete, if you look at the charts on compounding, they're really compelling. You can see that over time, that chart is like a hockey stick going up. But what people don't understand is that that chart is based upon one really important principle, and that is every bit of income that you generate from that portfolio is reinvested. So if you were saying, oh, I'm gonna take some of our profits from this year and we're gonna take a vacation. Sorry, you just lost the power of compounding, because compounding is incorporated in all the compounding calculations is the reinvestment of income and any gains that you have. So in that course, and you know, I taught my nieces about this when they were young, is that buy and never sell. And of course, you can't just buy any individual stock and never sell, because you know, stocks can go down to zero. But as far as markets or all stocks in the world or something like that, once you find that instrument, buy and never sell. And then you can get the benefit of compounding. It's kind pretty of, simple.
I love the alien, by the way. It's kind of, by the time you actually gain the wisdom to know, yeah, because I've never crashed the car before, so it's kind of going, seatbelt, yeah. And then you get on in years and all the rest, and you have your midlife crash and do whatever, and you're going, yeah, I should really have hurt, put my seatbelt on, that hurt. But it's kind of going.
Exactly. And when you think about what we neglect with young people nowadays, I would say we neglect educating them on nutrition. And so they are subject to the advertising of big food companies. And so they, it's so hard for young people to live a really healthy life in that way. And we also neglect, you know, the idea of understanding finance and investing. And I would say not understanding it in the sense of, I want to learn how to pick stocks. That's not what most people need. They just need to know the seatbelt, the airbag, and how to take advantage of the compounding. I mean, we could get rid of poverty practically in this world. We could get every kid to have an education. If we said government, when a child is born, the government sets aside $1,000, $5,000, whatever that number is. And we could calculate that forward and say, when that child is 18, there will be enough money that they can go to university. You could guarantee that every single child that's born, let's say in America as an example, that they're born with the ability to go to university, and the parents wouldn't have to worry about it. It's just done. But instead, you know, we think about finance from the other angle of how do we fix it, you know, in later years rather than doing it early.
It's funny you talk about investing in children. There was, again, we do love these sort of stories, but there was someone had said about, you know, a child, if you put in, here in the UK, we have an ISA scheme, it's called, so an interest savings account, basically. But if you put in £2,500 a year, it's tax-free income and it's rolled back in, but £2,500 a year for the child's first 18 years, by the time they hit 50, theoretically, that will be £1 million pot, which is kind of like mind-blowing.
Yep.
But then as you say, people go, yeah, but I really want to go on holiday. It's like, and I probably won't be alive in 50 years' time, so screw them.
Yeah. It's such a hard thing because, yeah, the gains. I read a good book when I was young called The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. And, you know, he had one section on delayed gratification and said that, you know, happiness comes from delaying gratification. That the discipline of delaying gratification is an important characteristic to build in ourselves. And I took it to heart. In fact, I picked up that book after 30 years and not reading it, and maybe even longer, 38 years. And I was like, I kind of forgot I had read it. And I was like, man, I really live by this. I really love what this book is about. And I kind of went, oh, wait a minute. That's because I read it at a formative time and I incorporated it into my life.
What does Fire in the Belly mean to you?
Well, I would say, I guess I would put it in terms of a question I always get, like, how do you get up every morning? I wake up about 4 a.m. most days. Occasionally I'll go to 5, but generally not. And I usually will exercise, but other days I'll just dive into work. And I don't work late, you know, I don't work till 9 or 10 at night. I always finish it maybe 5 or 6 or whatever. And, but I always jump out of bed and get into the thing that I'm interested in right now. So, for me, fire in the belly means I don't need an alarm clock. So I haven't used an alarm clock in 29 years since the day I moved to Thailand, because Thai people see time differently, and, you know, Asian people see time differently. And I wanted to kind of think about things differently. So I got rid of my alarm clock, but I didn't then start sleeping in. I started just waking up at fixed time. So, but the point is that the idea of jumping out of bed, I love that. I just jump out of bed. Fitbit, I wear a Fitbit to measure everything, and being an analyst, my mother wears a Fitbit, and then I'm able to track all of that. And it's helped me a lot in the way I try to help make sure she's living a healthy life. But the Fitbit shows how much time that you've been in bed, but not asleep. I think awake, they call that. So you've got REM sleep, you've got deep sleep, and then you've got light sleep or whatever they call it. And then there's awake time. For me, I don't have much awake time. I'm much lower than the typical man my age according to Fitbit, and part of that's because I just jump out
don't
of bed
mess around. I like it. That's a great way of putting it. You know, if you don't, it's true. I mean, I say to people, you know when you find your fire in your belly, because you're either googling at 2 o'clock in the morning and sending emails and pestering people. So, you know, when you're kind of going, any normal sane person is asleep right now, or vice versa. You say you're getting up because you want to, you know, you're turning up because it's great. You're reading the extra book, you're taking the extra 5 steps, whatever it is, you know, it's really sort of going that extra bit. What did Andre want to do when he grew up? What was the original plan?
Well, I can remember when I was in the drug rehab and I was just kind of getting myself straight. And my goal, I did a little work in, I was in electronics in school. I kind of went the vocational school route because I saw that if I went to the vocational school route, I was able to drive on a bus to another school in another area which I just figured that was, you know, a half an hour of time I didn't have to be in a classroom. So I thought I was getting away from it. And so I did electronics, and I did really enjoy that and learning about resistors and all that type of stuff, capacitors. And that was 1981, 1982. So I would have been in the cutting edge of the computer age, but I just thought about repairing TVs. That's what I thought was pretty cool. And I knew an older guy that had his own little house, very little house. And he had his TV and he sat in front of there all day and came home from work. And that was where I thought, that was my first kind of vision of where I would be. And so I would say that that was kind of, you know, the first time I thought about that. And then, you know, again, you know, going back to the concept of rocket, you know, rocketing, I rocketed. I had so much energy and so much excitement that I just rocketed. And so I went far beyond that. I can remember in 1993, when I took up the job as an analyst, I told my boss, he was a British guy, really, really, really bright guy and a good friend up until this day. And I said, I want to be the number one analyst in Thailand. And he looked at me and says, yeah, you could probably do that. You know, he wasn't, that wasn't his type of thing, but he was like, yep, you could probably do that. And as I wrote a blog post about it on my blog, which is called becomeabetterinvestor.net. And I wrote a blog post and said, I lost for 14 years. It took me 14 years to become a number one analyst. I mean, I got off track and all that. Lots of different things happened along the way. But the point is that what I try to use it as an illustration to young people that, you know, just because you set a goal and you work really hard to it towards it doesn't mean you're going to get it in 1 year, 3 years. Are you willing to wait 14 years? You know, or are you going to abandon it after 6 months and not getting there? You know, I think the podcast is a good example where you just put one foot in front of another, the other. You know, that's such a critical thing, is you got to just take the daily
steps. It's funny, I mean, I had some, I can't remember statistically the number of podcasts, especially at the moment, it feels like there's a lot more coming on the market, but statistically, probably like a new start, you know, the fail rate or the sort of the rate that they get to episode, you know, under 100 anyway, and then it just falls by the wayside. You get some bugger like me turns up, or yourself, that just keeps going, you know, and but that's, someone said to me, is like, just keep doing it for 2 years and then we'll talk, you know, and if you're still doing it in 2 years and you've been consistently doing it and all the rest, then okay, we know this is more than just a, you know, and it's so true, right? You know, you gotta, you know, I kind of always struck slightly by, you know, the Warren Buffett effect, you know, is how often do you check your stocks and shares? It's like, well, maybe next year I'll check them. It's like, where some people are daily, they're going through and, right, let's buy some, sell some, do some, right? You know, it's that, leave it the hell alone, build your plan and walk away.
Yep. Yeah, well, that's where it's a good lesson. One of the teachers I had when I was 24 years old was a guy named Dr. W. Edwards Deming, who was a pretty famous guy in the world of quality, often called the father of quality. And he, you know, he talked about the system, talked about working on the inputs and that the outputs would take care of themselves. And I think that's something that I took on board, that do the work, work on the system, work on the inputs and the outputs. You know, the outputs, there's a lot of variables that can cause outputs to not come out the way you expected. So, but by focusing on the inputs and doing the right things every day, you may find yourself in a very different location, but you're going to find yourself somewhere in, you're going to find yourself in a different location for sure. You know,
with investors, they talk generally, was it about this, there's two profiles. Typically you have sort of a greed profile or a risk profile, right? I think I mean, that's the, where do you trade from? What's your, yep.
Well, I think I've learned over the years, and I certainly learned from the podcast, but over the years I've learned that it's more important to protect your downside than to pick the next winner. I mean, if you're applying a methodology for picking stocks, as I do, by using a quantitative methodology and then combine that with some qualitative work. Then, and I use a structure called FVMR, fundamentals, valuation, momentum, and risk. I look at every stock in the world and every stock in Asia in particular, based upon those four variables. And once I've identified a list of stocks that looks interesting, then I go in deeper into those. But every time that I put stocks into the portfolio, I also put a stop loss of somewhere between 15 and 20 or so percent, with the idea that between now and my next rebalancing, which will happen in 3 months, if it goes down to that point, then I'm out. And that takes the pressure off, number one, of sitting up at night going, what do I do with this? And it also prevents me from losing, from seeing my losses spin out of control. You know, you're always going to lose and you're not always going to win when you do a stop loss, but you're not going to get caught up in losses spinning out of control. So that's how I would describe.
And that's so true, I suppose, in a number of things, really, isn't it, really? That, yes, we can all get great highs, but it's when there's a turn, you know, that you're going to catch it.
Yeah, I mean, I think about risk management is such an important thing. I was thinking about like professional athletes, like how many amazing athletes are there that are that could have been number one or leading in their field, and they hurt their elbow, you know, or their knee got torn. It's just one difficult injury that they couldn't recover from. And they had all the capacity to be a leader, to be number one, to be one of the best. No different from the guy that's there now. The difference, the only difference is that the guy that's there now didn't get injured. And I think that it's the same thing in life. And I realize now that a lot of what my parents were teaching me and what adults try to teach young people is, you know, where are the risks? You know, and they do that through lecturing and don't do this, do that, you know. But ultimately, what they're trying to do is help you avoid those risks. And we would all love to help our own kids or others not to have to make the same mistakes that we made. But, you know, unfortunately, people do. And in one of the most interesting responses in my podcast with the guy that I asked, you know, what would you say, you know, what advice would you give that would help our listeners avoid suffering the same fate? And, you know, normally someone says, don't do this, or, you know, do this or whatever. But he just said, make the investment, lose the money and learn. And in some ways, it was one of the most sincere answers. Like, yeah, you know.
It is so hard. Like, I mean, learn. But that's wisdom, right? You know, it's you can't impart wisdom either. You know, you can tell people, you can hope they learn, hope they listen. But you're kind of going, okay, stick your hand in the fire and then we'll talk about how you feel after.
Yes, pain and suffering have one impact, and that is it opens minds.
Mm.
I mean, it closes some, right? Some could get closed and so terrified that they never will open their mind. But for people who are striving, all of a sudden pain and suffering brings you to a vulnerable spot. Pete, I was just thinking about a good example about this was when I was in the rehab. This is a 7-month treatment program. So I really knew my counselors well, and I knew the other patients well. My counselor was saying, like, you don't get it. You know, you still think you're in control, and, you know, you're going to go out there and you're going to get high and you're going to whatever. And I was like, no, I get it. I get it. You know, I intellectualize it. But he said, you don't really understand the word powerless, you know, powerless. What does powerless mean over drugs and alcohol and all that? I was like, I understand. You don't have power, you know, whatever. And he said, well, would you be willing to do a little exercise? And I said, yeah, I'll do something. I'll do whatever you say. So he said, okay, lay down on the floor. So I was on the floor facing the ceiling. There was about 8 kids in that room. And he asked each one of them to put their hands and a little bit of weight on a different, you know, part, a different leg and my chest and my, you know, my head, everything to hold me down. And then he said to me, get up. And then I tried, you know, and I couldn't. And then I fought And I fought, tried. He's like, come on, come on, get up. And he went on like that. And I fought until eventually I lost my energy. And then I just started sobbing. And that was really a moment where I understood the idea of powerlessness. It was just made very real. I think I learned not necessarily through some kind of academic thing, but I learned through to doing it. And that taught me the meaning of powerlessness. And, you know, I think that that's a lesson I've carried all my life.
Oh, that's so powerful when you think about it, isn't it? I don't know why that's really struck with me.
Yeah. It's just this, I guess it helped me too. And I dealt with the death of my sister, when I dealt with the death of my father, that you realize that you are powerless over so many things in life. I mean, naturally we're raised to think that we have control of our destiny. But my other teacher, Dr. Deming, really talked a lot about the role of randomness in outcomes. And when you think about randomness, and that's another course I have called Transform Your Business with Dr. Deming's 14 points, where I break down what he taught, the way I thought about it. And, you know, I use an example of, you know, if you get 10,000 people in a stadium, you ask them all to stand up and flip a coin. And the people who picked heads go to one side, the people who picked tail go to the next. Now you tell them, flip again. Now, if you flip heads twice in a row, stay standing. Tails twice in a row, stay standing. But if you got the alternate one, sit down. So now you got 10,000 people in a and 5,000 on each side, and 2,500, half of those are sitting. And then you say, flip again. And now you have a certain number of people on the head side. They've already flipped heads twice. You know, now they flip heads a third time. And if you flip heads twice and then you flip tails, sit down. So now you're going to have 1,250 sit down. And if you go through that exercise 10 times in a row, you're going to end up with 10 people who picked heads 10 times in a row and 10 people out of 10,000 that picked tails 10 times in a row. So basically from that, what we can see is that there's randomness in that. It's purely random because it's a flip of a coin. So it's purely random. So now if you take that structure and you overlay that into your life, into your business, into your work environment, which is what Dr. Deming really taught a lot about, then you have to start to ask this question, which is, what role did randomness play in the outcome? And in the world of finance, where the interesting places that this is applied is in measuring the performance of fund managers. Maybe there's 10,000 fund managers out there, and every year there's half of them are beating the other half, and many of them are alternating between one year beating and one year losing. But there are some ones that persist in winning 10 years in a row, and there's some that persist in losing 10 years in a row. So the question that you have to ask in the world of finance is, okay, now and in the world in life in general, if we know that randomness has some play in our world and in our everything in our life, the question is, did those 10 people who won 10 times in a row investing, was it just pure luck? Was it just pure randomness that this guy ended up losing 10 and this guy ended up winning 10 years in a row? What role does randomness play in the outcome? And that is a whole area actually of research in the world of finance. And it's called I forgot the name of it. But the point is that the idea is that if you take that into real life, it's such a fascinating thing. And all of a sudden, it changes the way you think about about your own success and your own outcomes. But it also changes the way that you manage people. You start to realize that, wait a minute, this guy had really good sales numbers this year, so I gave him a bonus. And that one I didn't give anything to. And then next year, it's just a switch. It's like going to a McDonald's and looking at the employee of the month. They just rotate people through those, you know. So the point I'm making is that I challenge the listeners to ask the question, what role did randomness play in this outcome? And when you start to think about that, it humbles you, and you realize that actually, and that can be a fatal flaw of something like KPIs for individuals and things like that. The way we measure things does not take into consideration randomness, or else everything in society would just break down, because our society is built upon, you can do it. It's your effort. You can make it. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. You know, it's up to you, New York.
Do you relish in that? I mean, is there, you know, because for some, I suppose the randomness is kind of almost blows the mind to the point of going, well, what's the bloody point then? You know, right?
That's one of the common phrases in that course is, you blew my mind. And I think that I love that, because I love courses and books that blow my mind. So I love if I can come up with ways to get people to think about it. So for me, I've come to terms with it. It's just a natural thing. It's not so much relishing in it, or, you know, hating it or whatever. It's just the way life works. And if we deny it, it's like denying science, or, you know, I think the hard part is how do you attribute success to either randomness or effort? Where do you draw that line? Well, we don't draw that line in society. We say it's effort. But most people don't think about it. But I would challenge everybody listening to say, there is a factor of randomness in there.
Yeah, of course. Was it the old thing of, it's a mixture of, you know, the sort of more I work, the luckier I get, you know, and
exactly.
But then you throw in a randomness and a whatever else, if there's another par or something else at play as well.
And that's where the more I work, the luckier I get is the narrative of work hard to get your outcomes.
Mm.
And it doesn't acknowledge the fact that there absolutely is randomness underlying everything.
Where do you work?
You mean, where do I get my work done?
No, why? Why do you work?
Why do I work? I love discovering things. I love finishing things. I love creating things. You know, I loved creating this course, Finance Made Ridiculously Simple. And then to be able to walk into that class and in, you know, courses that I teach, and I basically say to the people who I have some game that we play, and I can identify who's good with math and numbers. And then I bring up half the class to the front that are good with math and numbers. And, you know, and then I look to them and I say, this course is not for you. I didn't write it for you. I wrote it for the people that are in the audience here. And what I try to do is write it for people that just finance is not accessible to them. It's frustrating. It's annoying, all that. So then in the live group, I set up teams and I ask the people in the audience, then I ask, let's say, the 10 people that I brought to the front of the room to stand in a row. And I ask people in the audience to stand behind one of them. And that's how we form the teams in the class. So there's a leader, you know, who's really good in it. And I say, okay, your job is to help. And then what we do is we move into the exercises where I say, as soon as you finish, stand up. You know, I'm going to teach you something. I'm going to give you a practice problem. And when you finish, stand up. But only stand up when your whole team is done and correctly solved that problem. And now all of a sudden you realize, you know, you get people helping each other. And then you get the people who understand it helping the ones that don't. And then that way I can promise to my students that you're going to end this class really knowing this topic. And that's, you know, I had one student say to me, I was terrified to do my MBA. He's doing an executive MBA because I studied political science. And I thought finance was going to kill me. And you've given me hope that I'm going to pass and make it. So
that's
why I work.
That's a superpower in itself to, you know, to explain something simply is quite something, right?
Yeah. But I use the trick. I use the power of the 10 smart people in finance in the front of the class, and then they ended up helping everybody else. So any tricks we can deploy.
That's true. I mean, what's it? You know, learning to know or learning to understand is different to learning to teaching, is different to learning to, you know, reinventing.
To apply.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, it's a whole other level. Wow.
Yep.
What's a guilty pleasure for you, Andrew?
I occasionally have a cigar. That's kind of a fun thing. And I've been indulging in way too much. My mother loves dessert, so I end up having, every time we go out, which is quite often, I'm eating too much dessert. But I would say for me, like a nice weekend is to take my mom to the beach where there's a resort not far from where we live in Bangkok, so an hour and a half, and then go there. And then just to stay in bed all day. And this particular beach, this particular hotel is nice because your bed looks out the window, and a lot of the rooms don't do that for some reason. So I can just be in bed and read and relax. And so, yeah, that's my luxury, but I don't do it out often.
What's your go-to on the cigars?
I used to like the Partagas and I like the Epicure, but I'm not an expert on them. And, but yeah, I just it's fun. Are you have some experience in that area?
No, I don't. I love the detail that people go, you know, and that it's, you know, guilty pleasure. Some people struggle with the actual term guilty pleasure, you know, and saying, well, why should I feel guilt? So it's like, well, I don't mind. Call it what you want. A leisure and pleasure, you know, what you get out. Cause you get people, it's a very serious topic. And then you go, I love chocolate. And the smiles from here to here. And suddenly you've got somebody that corporately very, very strong, but yet they're kind of going, I would melt for
exactly
the cigar I'd do for this, you know, because it's true, right? You know, it's more than just about the, you know, the game and everything else. It's just so much bigger.
Yep.
You know, it's what in one or two words then is your fire in the belly?
I guess for me, I want to prove to the world. I want to show the world. I want to show the world that I can bring finance to the masses. I can help people who don't understand it, and I can help them begin to apply it, to apply the compounding when it comes to personally investing, to apply the principles of understanding financial statements and stuff in business. You know, my goal is to have, as I say, for that, when I, 10 years from now, I want someone to come to me and say, because I took your course, because I studied with you, because I learned with you, I read your book, I now have, you know, $400,000 that I've been growing and investing over time, and I'm going to be able to retire. I think when I brought my mother to Thailand, my father, he worked for DuPont all of his life. My mother was a housewife. So it's a single earner family, and it wasn't like my parents were rich in any way. But when my mom came to Thailand and I brought her here, we went through her investment account, and I just said, you somehow managed to save and invest enough that you don't need to worry about money for the rest of your life. And you're here with me. So even if something happened, you don't need to worry about it. But my mother's financially independent at the age of 82. And that is so uncommon. So uncommon these days. So part of my fire in the belly and part of what I want to bring is help young people get that started now, because what an awful situation it would have been if she just didn't have that when my dad died. And that happens all around the world.
No, it's so true. It is so true. It's more than two words, but we'll let you away with it. But
oops. Sorry. Didn't listen to the question very well.
No, it's cool. It's no, because I mean, one thing that's sort of been coming through there, you know, is trust is seems to be a big value for you, if that's fair to say.
Yeah. Think so.
Yeah. Andrew, how can people reach out to you, follow you, find more information, track you down, stalk you?
The best way is go to myworstinvestmentever.com, and I'm there, and I reply to every every contact request. And if somebody wants to reach out on LinkedIn, Andrew Stotz, Stotz, or Z, and so I'm on LinkedIn. So I think those are two easy ways to get me right away.
And what's the final message you like to leave with people?
I guess if I was to define my life, it's simply that be happy with what you do. You know, don't be afraid to quit and leave what doesn't work. And don't be ashamed to pursue what makes you happy.
Lord, Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mighty Pete. I'm glad to be here and share some of my experience.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was another great episode of Fire in the Belly. You know, this really wouldn't be possible without our great guests taking the time to share their personal journeys. And boy, oh boy, sometimes it is personal. It's an absolute pleasure to have that, and then to hear the journeys that people have been on. We've loads more episodes coming up soon, and it's always a pleasure to have guests on. If you do happen to know anyone with true fire in their belly, please reach out to us so we can share their journey, lessons and successes. So, all that's left to say is have a great day, live with fire in your belly, and be the mightiest version of you.